Grab an umbrella. New research finds just how much wetter it's gotten thanks to climate change. It's Wednesday, October 12th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. The podcast forecast today calls for a look at America's maternal health care deserts and reflections on the war in Ukraine from a photographer who's been living and working there for years. But first, if you feel like rainstorms are more intense than they used to be, you're right. Researchers at Northwestern University found rainstorms have been dropping about 5% more rain on average on the eastern U.S. over the last three decades. The West, not so much. Ryan Harp is the study's lead author. He's a postdoc at Northwestern, and he talked to Deepa Fernandez.
Ryan, you and your co-author, Professor Daniel Horton, looked at rainfall over the last 70 or so years. Can you start by explaining why a warmer climate necessarily means more intense rainstorms?
Yeah, that's a great question. As our atmosphere warms, there is more moisture in the atmosphere, about 7% more moisture for every degree Celsius. And of course, as there's more moisture in the atmosphere, as you expect, there's more precipitation that can happen because of that.
So why doesn't that just mean it rains more often?
So part of that is due to the fact that there can be changes in storm tracks, changes in the locations of, let's say, high pressure systems that are going to suppress rainfall. And so there's a bit of a balance there.
Does it essentially mean that the clouds can just hold, because it's warmer, the clouds are holding the rain more, and then when it does rain, it kind of dumps?
Yeah, I think that's a nice short way to summarize it.
Okay. Is it too alarmist, Ryan, to call it like extreme rain?
So that's part of our study that is a little bit different. A lot of studies look at extreme rainfall, and we did look at the full distribution, so all of the rainfall that is happening. And so we think it gives a better idea of the full impact of our changing climate on precipitation.
So then you looked at different regions of the U.S. because there wasn't more rain everywhere. What did you see when you looked across the country?
Yeah, so for locations east of the Rockies, when it rains, it's raining about 5% more. We didn't see that same impact along the West Coast and over the Rocky Mountains. And we think it's due to, like I said, some of those changes in storm tracks and things of that nature that might be influencing and dampening the extra precipitation we'd expect to see due to a wetter atmosphere.
And in the West, where I live, as you just mentioned, in California, there's been a two decades long mega drought, the driest it's been in more than 1,000 years. You know, do you feel like that might change at some point, given that the East is seeing heavier rain? Will we see that in the West?
That's a great question. I wish I knew. I know that the western part of our country is really struggling with drought, but unfortunately, what we looked at here isn't able to provide many answers for you.
So if it does rain more intensely, why is that a problem?
So precipitation intensity can affect things like agriculture. So more variable rainfall can reduce crop output. Our infrastructure is also tied to historical precipitation data, which if it's changing, like we're seeing here, can have an impact. And also things like natural hazards like flooding and landslides can be affected by even these not extreme but moderate precipitation events that we're looking at here.
And I guess in terms of the infrastructure that you mentioned, are places across the east of the country prepared for this in terms of their infrastructure?
I think historically speaking, we've designed our roads, buildings, et cetera, around a stable climate. And of course, as our climate is changing, that is not necessarily factored in. So perhaps some locations are trying to factor in these changes that we're seeing, but I imagine there's a lot of built infrastructure that is not going to be designed with these more intense rainfalls in mind.
Just finally, Ryan, do you have any advice for what people can do? If our infrastructure is not ready for it, what can we do if we live in an area where this heavy rainfall might be happening?
That's a great question. I think on the individual level, it's hard to know what to do to prepare for these outside of, you know, being aware of the natural hazards in your area. But I would say we should all be doing what we can to work to suppress our greenhouse gas emissions as much as possible and do things like drive less, try to enact climate-friendly policies, and all that can come from an individual effort.
Ryan Harp is lead author of a new study on rain and climate change. He's a postdoctoral research fellow at Northwestern University. Ryan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, millions of pregnant women don't have access to healthcare that would help them safely deliver their baby. Maternity care deserts in the U.S. That's after the break. More than a third of U.S. counties are maternity care deserts, where there's little or no access to obstetric care. And many of these deserts are in states that have recently restricted or banned abortion. Teresa Gaffney has been digging into the issue. She's a reporter with our partners at the health and medicine publication STAT. She spoke to Robin Young.
The March of Dimes, which is a nonprofit organization that did this research, they have a pretty strict definition of what a maternity care desert is. It's by the county level, and it's any county that doesn't have a hospital or birth center offering obstetric care, or they don't have any obstetric providers. And so places like rural Ohio, maybe Southeast Ohio, that means someone is living an hour or hours away from a hospital where they can see someone. The care just isn't there. It might take a really long time for an ambulance to get to them or for them to get to someplace they need care, not only in emergency situations, of course, but also further just regular checkups, right, prepartum, postpartum. The whole level of care is much harder to access.
Well, Teresa, I know your reporting features a midwife who had no one to call. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, I spoke to Lauren Genter. She's a certified professional midwife in Southeast Ohio. Many of the counties she works in are maternity care deserts. There aren't nearby hospitals. And so she was working with a family on a home birth. Everything was going fine. The baby had been delivered. When Lauren noticed that the mother was bleeding more than was normal, and so she wanted to be ready. You know, when you're in rural areas, you have to be ready to make decisions before they become emergencies. And so this family also was Amish. They didn't have a phone in the house. That's very common for Lauren and the people she treats. So she had to call, like, use her cell phone, find a spot that had cell service, which is also a huge issue in rural areas. The nearest hospital was 45 minutes away. When they finally got there, the family had never been to that facility. They had no records there. The mother did end up fine. You know, she was treated and everything was okay. But the clinician requested a follow-up appointment, and Lauren knew, like, that's not going to happen. This family didn't have insurance to pay for another visit. They didn't have a car to drive the long distance to the hospital. And that's very common in areas that are maternity care deserts.
I just want to be clear. We're also seeing attacks on reproductive health care, including abortion. We know that so many clinics that provide abortion, but also provide other kinds, you know, Planned Parenthood provides health care in general, planned mm-hmm. pregnancies, they're closing. Does that impact the health care that women need when they do get pregnant? Or is it also adding to women getting pregnant who may have chosen not to?
The experts I spoke to, they said it might seem ironic that the states where abortion access is being limited are also the places where access to care for a pregnant person is most limited. But limits on abortion go hand in hand with limits on maternity care. Anything that limits a person's ability to plan their pregnancy or the end of their pregnancy, it affects care overall.
Right. Well, but since 2005, over 180 rural hospitals, you know, full care hospitals, have closed in the U.S. Why is that?
You know, and the experts I spoke to, they said that it kind of feels like these hospitals are closing because hospital is run like a business. And it's, you know, it's about the bottom line. And some of the people I spoke to push back on the idea that there aren't clinicians and physicians who want to serve these areas. They say that there are, you know, there it's often people who grew up in these areas, who come from these areas, rural areas with not many clinicians. But for an individual provider, it's really hard to go in and start your own, you know, mom and pop clinic or office. Mm-hmm. And so when the larger hospital systems leave an area, it affects everyone.
Right. Well, and a lot of these women that we're talking about are poor, mm-hmm. Maybe Medicaid recipients. So, look, we know the healthcare system is stretched across the country. We're reading today about hospitals cutting back on their rooms for children's care because children's care doesn't make as much money for the hospitals as adult care does. Mm-hmm. So what is the thinking about how not having care for pregnant women can be addressed?
The authors of the report, they urge lawmakers to pass the Black Maternal Health and Momnibus Act. The U.S. is, as many people know, in a maternal care crisis. We have the highest maternal mortality rates among comparable wealthy countries, and that continues to increase over the years. And Black women in particular are 3 times more likely to die as a result of pregnancy than white women. This report also found that Black women are more likely to be in maternity care deserts. To try to combat this, they also recommend expanding Medicaid access based on income and also expanding the postpartum coverage period to a full year, whereas right now it's just 60 days. So there's a wide array of solutions that the report proposes. It's going to be a wide-ranging effort. There isn't going to be just one solution.
Yeah. Teresa Gaffney, a reporter with our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication, will link you to her writing at hereandnow.org. Teresa, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, a photographer in Ukraine had hoped his work could help prevent war. Now he tells Robin Young he's going further, setting up what he calls a guerrilla giving campaign to help areas devastated by the Russian invasion. Stick around.
This week's intensified Russian missile strikes in Ukraine made us think about photographer Mark Neville, who we spoke with from Ukraine in the first days of the war. A few years ago, this British expat moved to Ukraine, fell in love with it, and a Ukrainian woman who became his partner. Then, after Russia annexed Crimea in 2014 and hearing the drumbeat of further war, Mark released the book Stop Tanks With Books, a collection of photos of average Ukrainians, including some of the 2.5 million people displaced by the fighting in Crimea. He sent it to 750 world leaders and powerful figures, hoping it would stop the war he feared was coming, but that came, as we know. The Russians invaded just days after the book was released. Well, now Mark Neville has a new project, Postcode Ukraine. He calls it a guerrilla giving campaign. So far, he and others have delivered $200,000 worth of food and medical supplies, taking pictures at every turn. And Mark Neville joins us. Welcome back.
Thank you very much for having me back.
And I can't imagine your feelings as this war just has become, you know, obscene. And you saw it coming. Just your thoughts as it's maybe gotten worse than even than you thought.
Nothing really prepares you for when it actually happens. You know, I still remember the day, the 24th of February, when we were woken up, my partner and I, by sirens and explosions in Kiev. And then you just go into kind of shock. We stayed in Ukraine for about a week. And then we, because my partner has underlying health issues, we decided we absolutely needed to get her out of Ukraine. And we went across the border as refugees with millions of others to Poland. Mm. I returned in March for 10 days on my own, during which time my partner was petrified. You know, she imagined the worst. And in fact, it was quite a dangerous time to return then. Kiev was surrounded on three sides. And then out of the blue, something remarkable happened. One of the recipients of my book, Stop Tanks With Books, which, as you said, was sent out to the international community. And one of those recipients was an art collector, a collector of my photographs. And he reached out and he said, "What can I do to help?" And I said, "Well, people really need humanitarian aid. And I want to help. And I don't feel it's enough just to take photographs." You know, I have to say, up until that moment, I always believed that art could change the world, that, you know, what I was doing had real social function and real social purpose. And I think it does. But in the face of people being bombed and shelled and killed, I realized I needed to do more. So I proposed a kind of fusion between humanitarian aid and documentary.
And this was the Postcode Ukraine, and we're going to get to that. And obviously people responded, and you've received funds, and also you're taking pictures of what's been happening now, a series of them that we see that you sent us. And by the way, we'll have everything at herenow.org. But that book, your first book, Stop Tanks with Books, has become a compelling memorial. We understand, you know, many of the people in the book have been killed in the war. Can you tell us about any of them?
That's one of the very desperately sad things about photography, is it captures things that change. You know, buildings get torn down and people die in war. And one of many of the people I documented over the past 8 years have been killed by Russian soldiers. And these are civilians. There's one guy who I was very fond of, Alexander, who ran a goat farm in Zhytomyr. And a remarkable man, very strong, disabled with one leg. I found out only 2 weeks ago he was shot dead by soldiers as he sat in his wheelchair at home.
Holding a goat. It's so tender. It's so rustic. It's so non-threatening, you know? This man, and it looks like his son, maybe, with their goats.
Yes, it's a local boy who just helps him out on the farm. Ah. But I can't understand it. I can't understand why he needed to die. I don't know. You know, I just have no words, really.
Yeah. Looking at these pictures, there's something about the light. There is a sharpness. I mean, there's a little boy kind of cocky with his hand on his hip. There's a fierceness about them. Can you describe what that is that I'm seeing?
Well, I think what I'm really trying to do with my new images since the war escalated in February is try and make images which are so surreal and so unusual and striking for people in the West that they're prompted to re-engage with the war, because I know so many people are feeling exhausted, not just people in Ukraine, but also in terms of compassion from the West.
Well, for instance, here's a beautiful girl. Again, she's got this light on her. She looks like Twiggy in a little mini dress. And yes. It almost looks like you photoshopped her in front of a destroyed Russian tank on a street.
What I try and do with the light, particularly the new images, most of which are shot in black and white, is really focus on the surreal. And that's my feeling about this war. It's so surreal, because if you were to visit Kiev now, even now, you'd think, gosh, what a happy, positive, vibrant, busy city. So you've got this real positive life on the one hand, and then you've got these carcasses of tanks everywhere. You've got people who've lost family members. Even now, I've got friends who, you know, whose parents are being shelled day and night in Zaporizhia. It's just totally perverse, disgusting, and absurd. This sense of the real and the now contains both everyday life, and it contains this ongoing war.
Here's a couple more examples. There's a young boy in what looks like a school uniform, you know, a jacket with an insignia on it and short pants. He's probably around 10, but he's standing in front of a completely bombed out school. It's just the rubble of a school. Here's another boy. Yeah. He's kneeling next to a burned out tank, and he found a mine. The gazes at the camera are just astonishing. What do you want people to do now through your new project?
Well, I hope people respond to the pictures, and I hope they engage with Ukraine, and I hope they can donate. Any donations we receive go direct to people who need it. So in other words, they won't go on wages, they won't go on overheads, they won't go on petrol. And the kind of things we're doing is we're helping other charities direct on the ground who are evacuating civilians from Kharkov as it's being bombed, providing heaters for people who are homeless. The winter's going to be awful. It's going to be absolutely dreadful. Many people will freeze to death here. We're providing iPads for kids so that they can carry on receiving education online. It's absolutely shocking. As we travel around Ukraine, we see that schools have been deliberately targeted. Museums. Sorry. Schools, museums, and kindergartens. And it's really hits you that this is a genocide, you know. The aim of the Kremlin is to wipe out the Ukrainian nation. Quite often, we'll go to some of these small villages 10 or 15 kilometers away from Kiev center, and there'll be a group of young people just sat in a field. And they're sat in a field because normally they would be going to school, but there's no school left.
I can hear your despair. I can hear your own trauma. Generations are going to pass on this traumatic
yes.
wound. I'm wondering if, in addition to documenting for the Ukrainian people this despair of what's happening, you're also documenting their nerves of steel and their pride. That's in these pictures too.
Yeah, I mean, I hope so. I mean, the process of rebuilding has been incredibly quick, you know, and that's one of the things that Postcode Ukraine has helped with. We provide funds for people to build new roofs for their homes, you know. And as soon as these areas were deoccupied, and many of them are still being deoccupied, people just get to work rebuilding their homes, trying to get an income, trying to get jobs. And, you know, we've given up, a lot of us in the West, in terms of fighting for what we believe in, you know. But Ukrainians, they're prepared to fight for an education system. They're prepared to fight for free elections.
As you travel through this, you know, the war-torn Ukraine, what are the images that you're going to carry with you in your mind's eye? Maybe you saw them. Maybe you saw them through the lens. I don't know.
Yes. I mean, the pictures I took of children sat in a burnt out school bus in Bogdanivka, that's days with me. And these kids whose school bus was targeted, you know, as part of the project, I kind of said, well, you know, what would you like me to photograph? I'm here. I've got my camera kit with me. What would you like me to photograph? And they just said, come back to our school when it's been rebuilt and photograph that, please. And that completely reduced me to tears again as well. And there's a mother and daughter called Masha and Nina, who are also from Kiev region, and they run a farm with a couple of cows and some chickens. And they described their occupation. They said that, you know, these Russian tanks arrived and they destroyed every single flat-screen television in the whole village. The troops had never seen a flat-screen television before, so they imagined these were some kind of military hardware.
Mm.
Nina, who's 17, she cut all her hair off on the first day of the war because her mother said that, you know, she might be raped. So she did everything to diminish that possibility. Just people's just incredible strength.
Yeah.
Refusal to give in.
Well, Mark, you tell their compelling story, and the photographs are going to post all of them at hereandnow.org, as well as how people can get in touch with Postcode Ukraine, your new guerrilla giving charity. Mark Neville, please stay safe and stay in touch. You keep us in touch. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin. Thank you.
This podcast comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. And if you like what you've been hearing, we'd love it if you could tell a friend about Here and Now anytime. You could even go so far as to rate us on iTunes and Spotify. It helps us get the show to more listeners. And thanks. As always, you can find a lot more from our radio show at hereandnow.org. Today, we've got two cooking segments you'll want to hear. Deepa meets longtime Here and Now chef Kathy Gunst and bonds over a love of pears, for which Kathy's got some great recipes. And Robin talks to the author of a cookbook on sheet pan baking.
I just find Rice Krispie treats can be so sickly sweet sometimes. Offsetting them with that brown butter and a little hint of salt really makes them sing for me.
That sounds pretty good. Today's stories were produced by Jill Ryan, Kalyani Saxena, and Karen Miller-Medson. Todd Munt and Gabe Bullard edited the show. Our technical directors are Mike Moschetto and Max Liebman. Theme music by Mike and Max, as well as me, Chris Bentley. The executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.